Octa Non Verba is a show that's raw and real, featuring hard-hitting interviews with people that live by the ethos of actions, not words. Marcus Aurelius Anderson is a TEDx speaker, best-selling author, veteran, and leadership and mindset coach. With this show, you get to join Marcus as he goes inside the minds and experiences of the world's most successful warriors, leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts. With each episode, you're going to get the philosophies, concepts, tactics, and strategies these leaders use to turn adversity into victory. Live an extraordinary life based on actions, not words. Now, here's your host, Marcus Aurelius Anderson.
Octa Non Verba is a Latin phrase that means actions, not words. If you want to know what somebody truly believed, don't listen to their words. Instead, observe their actions. I'm Marcus Aurelius Anderson, and my guest today truly embodies that phrase. Lee McKinney is a songwriter. He is most known as the guitarist, composer, and incredible musician in the American metal band Born of Osiris. And with this band, he has released 8 albums, 6 of which have been Billboard Top 100 albums that have been released. He also has 2 full solo albums of his own and a 3rd entitled To Those That Know Pain, which is coming out later this year. His current album is called Overwhelming Love, which I highly recommend. It's available now, so go get it. Between Born of Osiris and his solo music, Lee has been touring the world since 2007. He is sponsored by Kiesel Guitars, which in and of itself should give you an example of the quality and caliber of the man that I'm speaking to. And more importantly, I've listened to his music when I go to speak now as a keynote speaker all over the world. When they say, we want a walkout song for you, I use his truth speaker because that to me makes the most sense. The truth sayer makes the most sense of what I'm trying to convey. And when I walk out on stage, I was talking to you earlier before we hit record. People say your music has this additional element that they can't really put their finger on it, but it's this additional texture and this depth that really makes impact with them. So thank you for being there and thank you for being on the show.
Yeah.
I guess more importantly, the idea is, how is that emotion put into the music? Because when it hits people in the face, it's undeniable.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So when I was young, my dad was a metalhead kind of in a way. And so he would show me metal and all the guitar players would inspire me. And there was one in particular called Randy Rhoads, and he played guitar for Ozzy Osbourne.
Yes.
And I just found myself when he would play guitar, after the song was over, later on in my day, I would be singing his guitar parts in my head, almost like a vocal melody. And being a guitar player, it's kind of just been my way to sing and speak. You know, as corny as that may sound, but it's kind of my voice that I have available to me. You know, I'm in a band with 2 amazing vocalists, and that's kind of my way. And then, you know, with the solo stuff, that was the goal. It was to just write this emotional music that they're kind of diary entries in a way. It's funny, I've been saying this for years that my music is diary entries, and it's how I'm feeling this day, whether it's good or bad or happy, sad, triumphant, whatever it could be. I capture that, you know, via music. And it's funny, I saw a podcast with Rick Rubin the other day, who's a very incredible producer.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Huberman, who's another podcast that I like to watch. And he said something the same. He's like, these are just diary entries, but that's really what it is, you know? And so you'll have, it's funny, some of my music, my solo stuff, people will be like, oh, this record is so happy. And I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah, it was a great time. And then I have this record coming out this year called To Those Who Know Pain. And it's just extremely dark because of what was going on in my life at this point in time. And so it truly just goes to show that, you know, you can be intentional. You know, I think it's good to have goals with whatever you're doing with your life. It helps you stay on track. But there's an aspect to what I do with this art that you can have goals, but sonically, it kind of comes to you. You know, life experiences come to you and they shape the sound of your music. And so I'm blessed to do it. You know, I think that we also talked right before we hit record that I was raised by this macho man, you know, a father. He was a bodybuilder. He was a private investigator, owned companies. He's just this huge figure in my life. I'm so blessed. And I've always strived to be him. So we ride Harleys together. We like loud cars. We like firearms. You know, we like all this fun stuff. But, and I think it's cool. And I think there's things about men that should remain manly. And so I think that I've had this this yin and yang in my life where I think that at times I can get emotions out in a healthy way through art and through music. And that allows me to be this other person who likes to try to be a positive male figure. It's interesting to say that, but I've been in this industry for 15 years or more. And so whether I like it or not, there are people that kind of watch what I do. I like to do the best I can for them. And I didn't always. And so with what I can do now, I'm going to try.
You said that you weren't, you hadn't always tried to be that example. Mm-hmm. What made you want to change?
I can skip some time, but I'll start at the beginning and then hop to the last few years. But I was 17 when my record label came to me and offered me a record contract.
Wow.
And I had to wait till my birthday to sign it. Right. And so the day after high school, I was on tour traveling the world, and our first record did well. And so you find these things where you're 18, you're given, that was my dream and I already had it, you know? And so there's an element, first of all, I'm so thankful. But second of all, there's just a lot of things you learn from 18 to 21. There's a lot of things you learn from 21 to 30. And the thing was, is that people watched me learn them. You know what I mean? And this is a small level. Don't think that I'm trying to be like, oh, I'm Justin Bieber in a way, because obviously that's not the case. But what I mean is, like, when you see people, even on my very small level, people that enjoyed my music got to watch me screw up when I was 18, or screw up when I was 19, and screw up when I was 20 and 21. And then, oh, I like that pill too much and I like to drink. And then, oh man, these drugs are fun when I start drinking. And don't worry, I'm not going down too bad of a road here. But what happened was, long story short, in 2022, things kind of hit a peak, and we can talk as much or as little as you want about it. I'm open book on it, but I ended up in a coma. All these things just hit a plateau. A peak, if you will. And so I'm in a coma for a month. I wake up, I don't know what's going on. I'd lost 60 pounds. I wake up, I'm skin and bone. My dad's here, my mother's here. I don't know what's going on. And I just realized I'd just been burning the candle at both ends for too long. And so, again, to condense all this, now I've been sober off of, I have zero addictions since 2022. Zero alcohol, zero. And that's fine if people want to drink, if they can control it. I just couldn't. That's what I mean when I say, you know, I didn't always provide the best example, but I'm going to do the best I can at this point in time.
Wow. There's so much in that. I can't imagine having my dream come true at 17 and signing a contract at 18 and getting to, like you said, emulate these people that you look up to. And that's a testament to the amount of talent and practice you put into it, which I want to unpack that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you know my story, you know, dying on the operating table twice, waking up at 40 years old, paralyzed from the neck down, being told I'd never walk again. Being slapped in the face by adversity is what makes us wake up and take notice. So that coma for you, clearly it had a huge effect and it made you turn your life around. How did that inform the music that you created thereafter?
Yeah, so this there's a part of me that feels like we have a lot in common in this aspect of considering now you talk about adversity being a gift. I feel that. However, the difference being, I brought this on myself and I don't get that confused. You know, I did that to myself and I have to deal with the consequences. Whereas from your story, from what I gathered, it sounded more of an accident in training. Yeah. It was me just thinking I was could do whatever I wanted for too long, you know. And that being said, so we'll go back, I guess, then to about before this kind of hit the peak. So I 17 years old, I get this record contract. I start touring the world. Everything's going great. I never have to get a job again. I just keep playing music and I'm blessed. And I always knew that. And by the way, one of the dangerous things about alcohol for me was I was not a problem. I wasn't the guy who was screaming at his friends. I wasn't angry. I wasn't talking down to my girlfriend, wife, none of that. And I think because of that, because I wasn't a problem, if anything, because people thought I was more friendly when I was drinking, I think that's what kept it to be acceptable in my life, you know? And so, no, I don't wish I was nasty drunk or anything, but like, because of that, it kept me going too long until my body just physically gave out. So 17 years old to get the contract, I'm touring from 2007 to 2020. And so we talked briefly about Spotify. Back in the day when I signed a record contract, for example, it was about album sales. And we got tour offers if you sold X amount of albums, first week sales is what it used to be, a big deal. Well, that changed. And I'm not here to, we can talk about it for sure if you'd like, but you know, I have Spotify. So that's not the road I'm going down, as much to say that it's a lot harder to be a musician these days financially. You get paid fractions of a fraction of a penny for a stream. And if you were to buy my record, I would get X amount of money. Well, to give me that amount of money now on Spotify, you have to listen to it so many times. I don't know the figure, but it's astronomical. The point of this is to say that touring is how you make a living. So I'm doing this till 2020, then obviously the pandemic comes. 2020, now I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm unable to tour, which is also how I bring in my money. So the issue there is you have to learn who you are without this gift of a career, let's call it. All of a sudden you're like, what am I? What do I do? That's one thing that can be, you know, hard for people to get hit in the face with out of nowhere. The next thing is you're going to have to learn that, but you're going to have to learn that with zero money coming in now. You don't get money anymore because that's your income and your career and who you identify yourself to be. This is all I've known in my adult life. So, you know, coincidentally, I was living in Texas at the time. Coincidentally, the only thing that was open was the liquor store. So I would go there even more. And I'll be honest with you, I was always very into fitness, was in great shape. I would always, off tour, would stop the drinking. And I had that very much under control. On tour, I was like, you know what? I worked hard, so now I can play hard. So I would drink for 30 days straight on tour. And it was a lot. But I would come home and I would work out 6 days a week and I would cut the drink. And I had that under control until 2020. Then I'm home every day, not making money. And now it's just like, now I'm just drinking every day. So now, instead of just like giving my body that break, now I have no breaks. And my issue at the time was when I would drink, I would like to do other extracurricular activities and drugs and things like that. And so that started kind of eating things away. Also around this time, there's a lot here. I was married. And what I find about marriage or maybe relationships in general is that, let's say you have an issue that you need to work on. I would go on tour. So we'd be like, all right, let's pause for a second. I'm going to go on tour. So we'll catch up on this when I get back, because we should do it face to face. We're not going to text each other about this. All right. So you kind of act like things are fine. But when you come back after I've been gone for a month, you kind of just miss each other so much that you're like, hold on, pause. Let's just like, it's passionate. It's personal. It's beautiful. You missed each other. Distance makes the heart grow fonder, all these things. And then right about the time you're like, all right, well, we should probably solve these issues, I'm gone again. So, all right. And so I feel like in my particular marriage at this point in time, and by the way, I'm not here to say anything negative about this person that was in my life. It was just a thing that we had ended up in with each other. It was a cycle that came to a head at the same time. I'm no longer touring. I'm no longer who I am. I no longer have money. And now all the problems that we had been putting to the side for however many years, now we got to deal with those too. So it all just kind of hit it ahead. And then I started drinking, whatever. Now we're going through a divorce because we couldn't figure that out, unfortunately. And so it was that 2020, 2021, 2022 is when I ended up in a coma for a month or 3 weeks. I was in a hospital for a little over a month, coma for 3 weeks. And I think this was a long, took you for a walk here, but just to come back to the point, how does it affect my music? Well, before that, I think it was really happy. Life was so good, I felt like, financially, career. Even though I was putting my problems aside and my relationship I thought was good until, you know, life hits you in the face and you realize, okay, we have to deal with stuff now. So the music was happy. And then I started writing this record that's coming out later in the year in 2020. And so the question you asked me was, how is it affected by the things going on in my life? It's just a really dark record because it's, oh, I don't have all these things in my life anymore. It's not just one lesson to learn and then you learn the next one. It's just like, I have to learn four huge life lessons at the same time or whatever it is. And so the record covers the pandemic, covers a relationship falling apart, divorce. It covers addiction because at this point, the drugs and alcohol kind of took over. It covers waking up after a coma. It covers learning to walk again. I had so much muscle atrophy and things like that. Just in 3 weeks, I can't imagine, you know, what you were dealing with. So, but just in a few weeks of a coma, you know, one, two steps takes the breath away from you. And you probably know this much better. All this. And then it also covers me going through this divorce, learning who I am. I think there's an aspect of when you're with someone, you want to, let's see, how do I put this? because I'm not an expert on this, obviously, but you want to be a good partner. So you may bend towards them. Let's say you're here. You might bend over here to meet her in the middle. Maybe she bends here. And so, but when that's not there anymore, you're also kind of learning, what do I like for me? Like, what are my passions without having to worry about what anybody else thinks? Now I live alone. It covers that. It covers hitting the road again. And again, I hadn't played a show without alcohol in my system. And now I'm 33 learning, do I even have the balls to get on stage in front of thousands of people without alcohol in my system? You know what I mean? So there's a lot. And so I'm sorry if I covered a million things just there, but hopefully I tried to answer your question.
No, this is what people need. This is what people want to know. This is what behind the music. I mean, because you're playing, for those of you that don't understand, the technical prowess that Lee has is astronomical. And then to be calmer and be able to execute in front of thousands of people can seem unnerving when you're like, I have to go up there. It's like ice cold blood running through my veins. And now, can I relax enough to play this arpeggio? Can I play these 64th notes? Can I actually hit these things? And when you're also, when you're doing it in real time in front of an audience, there's an additional element there, and you've got music and you've got the lights in your eyes, and you're trying to make sure you can hear this person and make sure your monitor's working. And if it's not, the last thing you need is to wonder, what's the next note? Or am I in the right key? Right. Or is my guitar out of tune? Like, these are things that you have to have, like it's breathing. So there's a tremendous amount of, when I speak on stage, it's the same way. When I did my TEDx, for those that have seen it, if you notice, for my TEDx, I was the very first person that got to speak. So that was a huge honor. But that means I was also the first person to go up there to have the AV. So if there was a problem with that remote, which if you watch, I have to click it 3 or 4 times because it's not hitting for whatever reason. That's fine. I have to be able to do that, still be here, present, deliver the emotion like it's breathing, and get to the next slide without losing focus, without saying, shit, can we start over? Because guess what? When you're on that stage, just like with what you're doing, you don't get to start over. You don't get to say, hey, guys, can we count back in to start over? It's like, sorry, we have to keep going.
Right. Yeah, that's the things that I think that alcohol in my mind helped me with, you know. And it's silly because that's the things that makes you feel like it greases the gears, and you're like, I'm a little bit less worried about X, Y, and Z. And if something goes wrong, then it's all good. What are you going to do? But what's interesting about that is when you're talking about coordination of your body and your fingers and limbs, and it's not necessarily the greatest thing either. You know what I mean? It's like it makes you feel good till you get to the stage, and then you're like, shit, maybe I partied a little too hard. That was a little too much tequila on that one. And so I feel like, yeah, that there was that aspect of coming out of that. It's like, not only that, I've been touring since 17, but drinking that whole time. And so then now I'm back on the road sober, worried about if I'm going to like have the balls to go on stage, but also every person that you're hanging out with before the show that hasn't seen you in a long time is like, what's wrong, dude? What's wrong with you? That's like, to be honest, nice to meet you, because this is me. This is who I am. And I'm honestly a quiet guy. And I'm honestly not the loudest, but you probably only saw me drinking and then getting myself mentally ready to do this job. You know, I loved playing guitar my whole life, but I don't think that I knew what I was signing up for as far as being an entertainer and getting in front of crowds. Because to me, like, if it's up to me, I would have like my small circle at my house in my backyard, having a barbecue and making and playing some rock music at night and stuff. So my love for the guitar brought me to this, and I'm by no means complaining, but there was an aspect of my personality that didn't necessarily work with the whole, oh, you're going to go on stage in front of thousands of people thing tonight, you know? So there's a lot of aspects to it. Above all, I know that I'm blessed. You say adversity is relative. You know, I think you said it in your TED talk. I think it was, you said it quickly, but to me, it was a big moment, a big phrase that you said when you said it. And I think that, you know, I'm sitting here kind of complaining about certain things, but at the end of the day, there's so many people that would love to do and what I do. And I'm so blessed to do it, you know?
And I love that you gave that counterpoint. And adversity is still the same, though. It's still real adversity. And again, I love that you're pointing out these hardships, because when people do see you on stage, it's like, this guy gets to do what I want to do for a living. But like you said, there's always an additional component that comes with that. And the fact that you're willing to shed a light on this, because we do know plenty of musicians that get addicted to this, or entertainers, or whatever it is. And to give a 17-year-old kid the keys to the kingdom and expect him to be on a straight and narrow from day one, I think we may be kidding ourselves a little bit, right? I mean, that's, yeah. you're right. this this guy go crazy. Mm-hmm. So being in that coma and having that adversity, what was the big gift for you that you continue to walk with?
Man, I have got to say that, so that was the biggest hardship in my life, the biggest adversity, physically, mentally, everything. But if I were to look back at other times that were not as bad, but they were also adversity, let's say, the biggest and most growth I've made as a human, mentally, intelligence, just under the hood, the most growth I've ever made has been through these moments. And it's tough because you want to say, like, I mean, it was hell. And I almost didn't make it. But man, and it's tough to say, would I go back? Like, would I want it to happen again? I don't know about that, but it's like, but I can say that, you know, I read more books. I've been a lifelong book reader, and it's a passion of mine, and it's how I organize my thoughts outside of music. But I read more, you know, aside from reading, there's an aspect. So when I got out of the hospital, I was off for 6 months, you know, just gaining my strength, just getting healthy to do anything again, really. And those are the times that, again, and now I'm sober. And so those are the times that you have like hundreds of conversations with yourself that you've been putting off for so long that you might have needed to have since you were 18 years old, that you just found a way to put off because life sometimes feels like it's not real. Like you're like, I'm going where to do what? It's silly, but it's there was a lot of conversations I need to have with myself, and I finally had them. And so the gift, and it is a gift, is that I got to see what's important to me at the end of the day for real. Like when everything is taken away from you, every single thing, including almost you're down to your last breath. There was machines that even keeping me alive. It's crazy to think about, but like what really matters? You know what I mean? Like, and I feel like people can, if you're even sick, like a terrible fever and you're on the couch and you're going, man, I can't wait till I just feel better again. I'm going to do this, this, and this. It's like, man, when you're like times 20 that and you've been there, so you know, it's like, what am I going to do differently when I'm out of here? And so the gift would be all the work I did under the hood. And that would be learning what matters, learning what's silly. You know, in music, for example, I'll give you just one. You're worried about how you look on stage, or what does this do for the optics of the band? And at the end of the day, you're like, man, it's the music, you know? And so that's just one example. But the gift is I learned what matters to me. I learned what I could do differently because I didn't know if I was going to get the chance. I should say this. When I left, I had I was in septic shock when I went into a coma.
Wow.
And so that does damage to all of your organs. And I lost a lot of my pancreas at this point. It was necrotic. Part of my pancreas was necrotic. Mm-hmm. And so basically I was in a coma for 3 weeks. I was up for a couple of weeks. And at this point I can't sleep in this hospital. The beeping, they're checking on me every 3 hours. I'm not getting any sleep.
Yes.
And I'm losing my mind. And I'm like, I think this is irrational, but in my mind, I'm like, I think I'd rather die than stay here any longer. And so I talked to the doctor. I was like, I'm not doing good here, man. Like, I need to get out of here. What are my options? And he's like, well, I think you need to stay here. You need to have 3 more surgeries, 1 each week. Now, they're not open body crazy surgeries. I think he even went through, they wanted to go through down into your something to scrape off the necrotic part of the pancreas, then your stomach absorbs it instead of it getting infected again, if that makes sense. He said, now the chances of this are 50-50. You could go home and you could be 100%, or you could go home and come back again. You go into shock again, septic shock. He goes, if you go through that again after what you just went through physically, your body probably can't pull out of it a second time. And so that's what I mean when I say, you know, you get the chance to say, what would I do differently? But even in that moment, I didn't know that I was going to get that for sure, because I opted to go home. And I lived 3-4 miles from the hospital, Baylor Hospital in Dallas. I lived in downtown Dallas at the time. And so I said, I need to go home. I'm losing it. He said, your chances are 50-50. You end up right back here. I said, okay. Went home. Things went well. And so I'm thankful for that. But, you know, you're having those real conversations with yourself. What if you get the news that this isn't going well? What if you get the news that you got to go back and have these surgeries? what if you're, you know, you get the news that, you know what, you're good and can go. And that's thankfully what happened. They told me I was going to have a year of rehabilitation physically, among other things. I got so lucky that within a year I had performed in 24 countries. So in all of this, there's an aspect of luck that I'm very thankful for. No, I had to stop the drinking. I couldn't go back to doing any of those things. But outside of that, which is that's a very easy thing, I think, when you're faced with that much severity of consequence, I did what I could. And then I think things went pretty lucky for me. But yeah, the gift is the work you do under the hood mentally, the restructuring.
And that's the thing. For me, when I was 40 and that happened, I already knew all the lessons.
Wow.
Right? I knew all of that stuff, but I just wasn't doing it.
Right.
Because I thought, like you said, but that's a far away thing. That's going to happen to other people. That won't happen to me.
Right.
In some ways, it's even bad because joining the military at 38, wondering if my body and my mind could take it, and then excelling and going at a very high level of excellence, I was like, dude, I'm even more super, like, I'm, you know, bulletproof. You can't do anything to me.
Wow.
And then when you get punched in the face with that realness, and it's like, and now it's regret. Now it's anger. Now it's that depression that's mm-hmm. internal. Like you, I was suicidal, but I couldn't act on it. So talk about feeling like a victim. Talk about all that stuff that you wish you had done.
Yeah.
That's why your message to me, especially to these musicians that are out here now, these young people that are wanting to go out and do what you're doing, it is. It's a dream come true. It is a gift. But understand that right next to it, right adjacent to it, there can be darkness. And if you don't allow yourself that north, that purpose to drive you, just be really aware, because it's not something that you did intentionally. You didn't want to end up in a coma at that age. You didn't expect to have those things happen. And like you said, you're lucky that you still have the dexterity to crush it and destroy that axe the way you do, because like you said, there was neurological damage, whether there was damage in your fingers where maybe the pick hand works, but the left hand's not doing what you needed to do.
When you say that, I don't know why, but coming out, there was my left foot, my big toe, I couldn't move. I couldn't feel this part of my head. I couldn't feel my ring finger, and my left side of my thigh is still numb. And this is 2022. I don't know if it's luck or God or what, but I had no feeling in this finger, and it's just very important to what I'm doing.
Of course.
And so there's those moments where, like, I don't know if this is happening again, you know? There's just a lot of thoughts, you know? And those are the times in my life where I had been so used to, like, oh, something's stressing me out, I'm going to have a drink. Look what that got me, you know? And so you say adjacent to the life is this darkness. And that's true. And, you know, I think when I was growing up and getting my license at 16 and listening to Motley Crue driving around, just so pumped, I'm like, man, if I could do this, little did I know next year I was going to have a record contract to do it, but obviously not on that level, but how would I do it? What do they do? Oh, well, it's drinking. It's girls. This is what you do, man. Like that's just what you think it's supposed to be. That's Ozzy partied like crazy. Ozzy was my idol. And then it's like, oh, I love Pantera. What are they doing? They're drinking whiskey. It's like, what's Motley Crue? And I'm like, oh, so this is what you do. And damn, as someone who's now not drank for a year and a half, man, alcohol and rock and roll go together really, really good. And I can still say that, you know, I won't do it anymore. But damn, I understand how good that is.
I love that you talk about those influences at a young age. So you started playing the guitar at around 10 or 11, you said.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's correct.
And then within 6 years, you've hit the prowess and the technical capacity that people are like, we want to give you money to do this.
Mm-hmm.
As an author, every author I've spoken to, when I interviewed, you know, Robert Greene or Stephen Pressfield, I asked them, you know, what was that passage? What was that book? What was that writer that made you say, damn, I want to write something like that? And you mentioned Randy Rhoads and Ozzy before. Was that the musician that you heard? You were like, I want to sound like that. I want to be able to play Goodbye to Romance or do the guitar solo from Tribute or any of those kind of things. Was that what it was? You're smiling.
Yeah, it's funny. Tribute was, it's like, I think, was it a tribute to Randy Rhoads, that record? It was an Ozzy Live record, right?
And it was he and Randy. And I played that record until it warped and then got another one. It was a double album. I did it again.
That's it. Yeah. That's literally it. Tribute. I think on the CD, I can remember to this day, I think it was black CD, and it was Ozzy holding up Randy.
Right? Yeah. With the polka dot flying V, yeah.
iconic. So you literally hit it on the head. Tribute, that album. I remember. So my dad, I mentioned he owned a couple of companies. He had a company called Search, and it was two parts. One was Search Investigations, and one was Search Recovery. So Search Investigations was private investigated work. Search Recovery was towing. So if people couldn't pay their car payment, the bank would call and he would go tow their car. Not the most popular job, by the way, when you start doing that. However, I don't know the process, so I hope I'm not butchering it. But something basically happens where the car goes to a lot. So he had a lot of vehicles. If people pay their payment, they come get their car. If I remember correctly, if they don't pay for their car, it goes to auction, or at least in some cases. I don't fully remember. All I remember is there was just this corner of just like CDs that people didn't want, or they didn't come get, or maybe the car went to auction and then the property doesn't go to auction. I'm not quite sure how it goes down, but I would just sort through these CDs. And so my dad and I would just be driving and we just listen to rock and roll and metal, you know? And so that is a huge influence, you know, Randy Rhoads was it. And in his style of singing, I would say as a guitar player, was probably the biggest influence. You know, we may not use the same like scales per se, or maybe not sound harmonically the same, but the idea that he was doing is the same for me.
I think that makes a lot of sense as to why your music resonates with me literally so much, because I remember that there's a tribute from Guitar World that had Randy on the cover, and they made this big deal about it because the album was coming out.
Yeah,
went down and pedaled down on my bicycle and bought the album, and it blew me away. And my dad played the guitar, and I was impressed because he could, you know, play something by ear. He could hear something on the radio, and you know, it was C, D, and G or something simple. But to a young man, it's like, wow, you're a rock star. And then he taught me this thing called the bar chord, and it just changed everything, right?
Yeah, sure did.
And then I played until my fingers were uncomfortable and bled a little bit, and then I kind of lost, because I was still doing martial arts and still discovering girls and things like that. So I had a lot going on.
Right.
But when I got that album and I heard, you know, the opening thing, I Don't Know, and he's playing that pedal A, and you're trying to get that sound. And that made me redouble my efforts and say, okay, I need to buy this cheap Crate amp. I need to get the guitar. It was a cheapest Kramer that they had at my little store in Oklahoma. But that gave me the sound and it gave me the earphones. And I just spent as much time as I could. I bought the tab and I wore the book out trying to do it. So tab, for those of you that don't know, is the music, but it's actually kind of in a keyboard format for those of us that are not as musically inclined as, say, you are, Lee. and this is the part of it that I want to unpack for a lot of people, because we have these influences and we listen to something or we hear something or there's a quote or a solo that sticks out for us. And for me, and I talk about it in my book, but I didn't have the technical prowess to sound like Randy Rhoads. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the technical prowess to do the national anthem like Jimi Hendrix. But what it did was it helped me understand the importance of, like you said, scales, harmonic majors and minors, where I can use one pattern to go into the other one, and trying to just emulate those things, even though I couldn't do these sweep arpeggios as, you know, beautifully as you guys do. It still gave me the understanding, the tools. And then it gave me the idea of, this takes repetitions. I have to be in the woodshed constantly.
Yeah,
I can't just pick it up whenever it's convenient or easy. I mean, I can if I want to impress everybody around a campfire and on a summer evening. But if I really want to get good at this, I need to be able to understand what these things are. And so for you at that young age, would you say that you had sort of a natural gift for it, in addition to a work ethic to get you to the point to be a professional musician at 17?
You know, I think I can't tell you if I had a natural gift. I guess my parents would have said that. But my dad, he was just this pillar of inspiration in my life, said that, you know, you can do anything that you want to do. And like, he wanted to be a forest ranger. He just wanted to take care of animals in the local forest. And like, but it wasn't necessarily a career. He had a kid, he is married, like, and so his mind, he would do these other jobs for the family, would work hard, and I would see what hard work is. But he would also say, like, but for you, son, I want you to do what you want to do, and the only one that can stop you is the man in the mirror. He used to say that all the time. The only person that can stop you is the man in the mirror. He goes, and so when your friends are out on Saturday, if you want to be the best, you're at home playing guitar. If you want to go out, go out. But if you want to be the best, when they're partying, you're working. He would say all this stuff all the time. And so there was that. There was that strong father, you know, male figure in my life. And then there was also, so my parents divorced around 10 as well, around the time I started playing guitar. And in that process, something, I don't remember exactly the order of it, but I would go back and forth and they would also move. So between going back and forth and between them moving on their own, I was in a different school every year from sixth grade to senior year. And so it got to a point where like you go to a new school for this year and you're like, okay, I can make new friends and I probably will try a little bit, but who knows, in a year, I think mentally I'm like, I'm not gonna ever talk to you again. And so kind of guitar was also my constant. And so I think, you know, my father showing me what hard work is, truly making me believe that I was unstoppable if I worked hard enough. And then guitar kind of just being the anchor in my life when everything else was like a moving part. And I'm not complaining, by the way. I was very blessed, all things considered, as a kid, you know. But that being said, there were moving parts and the guitar wasn't going anywhere. So that was kind of just another layer of my commitment to it.
I think that's a great testament. There's so many people now that are understanding, not to the level that you did, but they're, you know, they listen to all these influencers, you know, Gary Vee is like, you know, kind of just focusing on this thing that you enjoy. But as a musician, as an artist, as an author, we're literally creating something out of nothing. Mm-hmm. And we have to do different things to put ourselves, to prime ourselves, to be able to win, so to speak, whether it be Stephen Pressfield, we talked about with the War of Art, where he discusses this notion of the muse and this discussion of you can't bullshit the muse, you can't fake it. Because it doesn't put up with it, much like adversity. It's like it doesn't care,
right?
So, could you give us a description of? And the beautiful thing is, I know that you, like, I could put you anywhere, and you could perform, and you could probably come up with something incredible. You probably have a riff that was in your head that just kind of came out. But ideally, your best music, what would kind of be your process? Would it be on stage? Would it be this notion of really working on it over and over again? Because I know that, say, Randy Rhoads, for example, he was very meticulous about the way he would harmonize, and he would double his guitar solos, which people that don't understand means that he would play the solo perfectly once and then double it again in another speaker, because back then they didn't have those ideas that, or the technology to do it. So to be able to get a flawless solo out once is big. Absolutely. But to be able to redouble it again, and he very much literally wrote out a lot of the notes. Can you describe to us sort of what the process is for you, and then what seems to be the thing that continues to give you that capacity to get in touch with the muse?
So when I was young, actually the drummer in my band is a multi-instrumentalist. And so around the time our band started, this is when home studios were kind of becoming popular. And that meant people more on a budget. I mean, it's still expensive at the time, because again, it's like the first of anything, even if it's home recording equipment, still is going to be expensive. But instead of paying an hourly insane fee in downtown Chicago, which is where we grew up, to rent a studio, again, still slightly expensive, but it was capable to trim it down and get it home and record. And so this around this time, my drummer had a in his basement in high school. And I was just seeing like how he would record guitar and record drums and stuff like that. And so, you know, I'm still in a band with him to this day, and he's still an inspiration to me. And, but he kind of showed me how the home studio thing worked. So I got a laptop and I got what I could. There was free programs at the time. I would rip, you know, when they're stealing programs or whatever was more of a thing in the Napster days or whatever. I would rip software. I guess people still do it, but at the time it's what I did. Started writing at home. Now, my band had a record contract and we would get budgets to go record with some of the best metal producers in the world. Again, something we're very blessed to do, but I was kind of that guy who, for better or for worse, whenever I was in the studio, was picking the guy's shoulder, like, hey, what'd you do there? How'd you do that? What'd you do there? How'd you do that? You know, so I was, and it might have annoyed him, the people that I was with, but it was each guy, let's say each amazing producer we got to work with at any level, we're all very fortunate and kind and gave me secrets. And so I would like kind of just collect them. And so along the way of my band gaining traction and touring, I'm gaining secrets, but you know, some producers don't share their wisdom. Yeah. I was very fortunate to be with people that would, and I'm thankful for that. But so I, along the way, my home studio setups would get better. My knowledge of how to do things would get better. So for me, I remember feeling like we did rent studio time in downtown Chicago when I was a kid once. And I remember I felt I was this guitar player. And then we would go there and I'm be on the clock paying $80 an hour or whatever. And I felt like my playing was down here. I'm like, I'm better than this, but I'm just nervous. I don't want to blow it for my guys. We all pooled our money from our pizza gigs together, whatever we were doing. And you're on the clock now. And now I'm like, man, I'm just a better guitar player than this, you know? And so I still had to do that for X amount of years. But when I got the home studio setup going, my process became very personal, very reclusive in a way. And now it's just the closest thing to my heart. My process is like diary entries. I just sit down every day. So there's going to be a lot to unpack here. So sorry if I talk too much, but
no, that's what we're doing. I want you to give all of it. Yeah, I want you to give all of it.
I say that there's no better feeling, even when I was addicted to things that I shouldn't have been addicted to, there's still no better feeling than finishing a song, walking around the room and listening to it and being proud of it. That is better than any drug ever. And it's healthy. There's zero downside to that. All you get is a benefit. It's the most beautiful thing in my life. And then I get to travel the world, and that's just another bonus. And there come so many things with that. So all these beautiful things that come with what I get to do, the favorite thing is the process right here. In this room right here, I wrote Overwhelming Love in this chair. And so it's the best, cheapest therapy. If anything, I get paid for my therapy. But it's like I wake up, my process is wake up in the morning. Now it's just coffee. I like to start early. It might be, have you read the book, The One Thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think it was in that book that he said something along the lines of, and I don't want to butcher it, but I do believe it's this book where he said something along the lines of, you're most fresh in the mornings, and attack that one thing early and attack it hard. And so I'd like to do it in the morning. Now, there's no right and wrong here. I know musicians that shine at 3 a.m. after a day, and now the lights are off and they're vibing. So there's no right or wrong here. But that book and me, we think of it the same way. I believe that the brain and your ears even fatigue throughout the day. Personally, I guess I should say, some people might get sharper throughout the day. My brain seems to go down. But so for me, I attack it in the morning with coffee. And then I work for a few hours. Then I'll have lunch. I treat it like a 9-to-5, my favorite 9-to-5 on earth. I would say when I have an appropriate, now this was different, like when I would live with a partner who may be home certain days, whatever. But if it's up to me, 9-to-5 weekdays is when I like to work. And I do like to take a couple of days off on the weekend. Now, I mentioned earlier the pandemic and how it was kind of hard on me for multiple reasons. It was actually hard on me for a songwriting point of view too, at the beginning, because if it was up to me, I would stay home and work on music and make enough money to do that. I'd probably tour a little less and be home writing songs a little more if it was up to me, but it isn't. And financially, at least, you kind of have to tour a lot. What was interesting at that time was now I'm forced home, whether I like it or not. That actually wasn't inspiring for me at all. It's quite the opposite. If you told me like before, like, hey, you're going to be stuck at home for a year, maybe two, I would have been like, I'm going to write so many songs. But man, it was quite the opposite. You know, also the world was kind of going to shit in so many ways. Politics were starting to divide people. Politics were dividing my own home. There was a lot of aspects to it. But yeah, the reason I bring that up is because the process would be mornings for me. And I love that. But you also need stimulation. And that's why I bring that up, because the pandemic wasn't giving it to me. So, for example, I'm off tour right now this month. So I'll go on tour next month on the 4th or 5th. We'll go to Europe. Now, until then, I can be in the studio every day. And you would think like, okay, that's the way to get the most things done, the most songs written or riffs or whatever it is. But it'll get to a point where, let's say, and the reason this is why I say Monday through Friday, it'll get to a point where the weekend comes around, I'm kind of feeling burnt a little bit, and I need to get out, whether that's go to a concert, find inspiration, it could be a movie with your lady, it could be something out of here. So there's like an aspect of this is my favorite place to be, to do my favorite thing, but I can't just be stuck in here either. So hopefully that answers your question on the process, but that's how it looks for me. Now that's how it starts, I should say, because with Born of Osiris, my band, songs are created here to a skeletal extent. So there'll be, let's say if I write a song, I'll write rough drums, guitars, bass, keys, and then I'll send it to the band where I have a incredible drummer, you know, and they'll make it their own and kind of thing. So the process before it gets to the listener, there's a lot more that happens. But my process here is mornings off tour.
Yeah, Stephen Pressfield talks about his process of, you know, getting up in the morning, attacking it. You were discussing Rick Rubin and how he very much creates this. He cultivates that environment that gives you the capacity to take chances and to feel safe enough to fail. Mm-hmm. Back to that point you were talking about, because I remember trying to play in my first guitar contest in this little bitty town in Oklahoma. And it was the same thing where I was trying to play the end of Crossroads, the Steve Vai with all the sweep arpeggios and all that stuff. And I just didn't have it. And so I went up there and I fumbled through a lot of it. And some of it was clean, but a lot of it was not. And I got beat by guys that were not very good, but technically they were able to hit those skills
right.
Very cleanly, even though they were not as good of a musician. Or in my mind, I was like, well, I'm better because I tried something harder. It's like, yeah, but
right. You
couldn't execute it.
Yeah.
So we talk about martial arts, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're in jiu-jitsu. It's like, oh, I got really good at this flying umo pilates. It's like, well, not really. You drilled it on somebody a little bit. In a live role, that's not going to happen, right? So, and then as you say, when you're under the pressure of all these people spending what seems like a lot of money to you at the time, mm-hmm. like you don't want to let these people down, it is difficult. And so I think it was incredible for you to really embrace that, like you said, that intimacy, that honesty, that ability to really figure out what it is, to really cultivate that and just, you know, wring that out of yourself. It's so powerful. And even to the pandemic point, much like what you were saying, the second book that I'm finally almost finished with, I started it around that time. But just like what you were saying, the way I was being informed by everything around me, mm-hmm. I was writing a bunch of stuff that really didn't feel like my natural voice.
Right.
Really, and almost a sophomore jinx as a musician, right? Like I had this first book that had some success and I had the speaking and these coachings and now I'm finally getting a taste of these things. And then it was like, is this, you know, in tune with my brand? Is this in tune with my voice? Is this really whatever? And like you said, there was all this divisiveness. And back at that time, both sides, they were rushing to the extremes because they wanted to continue to do these things. And it was just like, man, that's not who I am. And that's not what I feel. And
right.
Both sides have merit, but both sides have areas that are gray or not correct. Mm-hmm. So we can't just throw out the baby with the bathwater and everything.
Right.
And I think that even now I get attacked by, you know, conservatives, some conservatives say that I'm not conservative enough.
Right, right.
Some liberals are like, oh, you're all these things. And I noticed that people will read in to you, whether it be your music or what you write or what you speak on, they'll read into you the parts that they like, but they'll also kind of be repelled by the things that they aren't willing to take a look at, which, like you said, I really don't give a shit about your opinion. I want to write to the best of my ability to help you
right.
and come from my vantage point. And if it helps you, then great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be a hack. I'm not going to try to give you the 3 secrets to this and the 7 steps to that. It's like that stuff doesn't have any real significance in my opinion. The things that you're talking about, like there's no way for anybody else to understand how important that was for you to go through that adversity and that coma until we get to hear this new album, until we get to feel that just wash over us. But I think at the same time, being aware of those things allows you to decide, like you said, what do I want to do with this? How do I want to portray this? And I think that it's going to be a tremendous opportunity for people to get to hear even more about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, well, thanks. I hope people like it. You know, you mentioned briefly just now talking about your brand and a new book, which by the way, I'm excited about. That's amazing. And I'll be getting that, but
I'll send you one. Don't worry.
Oh, it'd be amazing. I've been this dude in the metal world since I was 17, since 2007. And that's what everyone knows me as the guitar player, flashy at times on the instrument. And so coming out of this coma and, you know, all that stuff happening, my life is completely different. My mind is clear. I know what I want. I know what's important to me. And there's really no wavering on that anymore. I wanted to write this song, Overwhelming Love, for example, which, by the way, for people who haven't heard, it's a softer song. And for the first time, I'm singing personally. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned earlier, I've been singing with my guitar for my whole life. Now I decided to do just a little bit of vocals. I'm not going to lead with it, for example, but basically the idea is that it would just be another instrument. Whereas usually it's the main instrument and then people do a guitar solo. If anything, for me, I'm going to be playing a lot of guitar. And then if I have something to say, I might say it, but maybe not even, but maybe. Anyways, the point being that 15 years in my career to put out a soft song with singing when I have gained just metal fans and metal fans and metal fans for the most part. That was a situation too, where I'm like looking like, what is my brand? Is that important to me? Like there's that line where you're doing it for yourself because this is your therapy. This is your diary. This is important. But you also like you're thankful for the people that keep you doing this and that support your art. And without them, you can't do it. I understand it's a cliche thing to say. I couldn't do it without you, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, it's a fact to an extent too. But people can smell bullshit, especially with art. And so there's a line that, you know, I think about. And I thought about it for a long time, is what's the line between, and again, I don't want to mistake this for art versus money. I want this to be art with integrity versus I still do want the people that have supported me to enjoy it. Not about because I want their money, but because I'm thankful for them and we're on this journey together. So that needs to be clear. But I think about that line. And I think when I woke up from a coma, I was like, you know what, my solo music is respectfully going to just be exactly what I want it to be and nothing else. And I'm not wavering on that anymore. Born of Osiris, my band, pays the bills. My solo stuff, everyone can hate it, but I need to say this right now. I need to do this right now. And I think in that process, people heard it. And I would say they knew that it was real and it went well, because without giving you too much on this, like the first album came out, and then I released the second one right before all this coma stuff happened. And so I kind of disappeared for a while and wasn't doing any content, which is never my favorite thing to do anyways. But on Spotify, you can look at an artist and it shows their popular songs, right? I had been like, my ego was hurt at the end of last year because nothing on my second record was even in my top songs. It was all my first record. The reason I bring this up was because I finally said, screw it. I'm going to do what I want to do. I hope people love it. I do, but I need to do this for me. This is who I am musically. And within a week, it was my second biggest song ever, as far as my solo stuff goes. And so I think people can see through bullshit. They can tell what's real. I think in a world of smoke and mirrors, in and around music, politics, anything, people just really respect raw, real, honest. And I think that it just worked for me. So I hope people continue to like it. I really do. This record was what it had to be, and it couldn't be anything else. I wouldn't have been real if it was anything else. But yeah, I hope people enjoy it.
Well, I love it, and everybody that I share it with or give it to, they enjoy it as well. I would love to ask you about, so we have a young musician, maybe not a guitarist, maybe viola, maybe a singer, maybe percussionist, whatever it is. People are always like, you know, advice I gave my 17-year-old self. Well, mm-hmm. That's bullshit, because it's impossible to have the breadth of knowledge of that at 17. And even if I went back to my 17-year-old self and said, do these things, I still would have listened to it because I didn't have the maturity. I didn't have the life experience. I didn't have the emotional intelligence to recognize it. I would just say, whatever, I'll keep it in mind. But if there is a young musician, and I mean as a musician, there may be like 40-year-olds out here that are like, I want to try to make my own music. It's like, this is what I would do. What would be sort of the steps or the advice that you would give to them to kind of set them up to win?
There's a couple aspects, a couple areas, a couple ways I'd answer the question. So first of one, sometimes I just get people who are maybe 40 and they write me like, hey, I want to start guitar. Like, you know, I got a full-time job and a family. What are the best steps towards this? And how do you deal with people being better than you? It's frustrating for me when I look at the TV and I can't do this. How do you feel when you see a guitar player do something you can't do? Blah, blah, blah. I think one thing is that I would say is, above all, make sure you're just enjoying it. And it sounds simple, but I tell, like, the guy who has time to come home, sit down and have dinner, be present with his family, and all he has time is to strum two chords on his acoustic guitar at the end of the night before bed. If he loves that and it makes him happy, then he wins. That's it. You already made it. Because what is making it and everything is relative and people have different goals and dreams. But I think as maybe a lackluster in answers that may be, I think that it should be led by just who you are and who cares what people can do, speed, the 64th notes, all that stuff. Just like if you smile when you strum that chord, then you win. Now, there's another way I'd answer the question. It would be for the young musician coming up right now. I might not be the best guy for this because, like I said, content is a big thing right now. And I've personally struggled with it because if it's not real, I don't want to do it. And here's what I mean. We're having a conversation right now. I've been looking forward to talking to you for a while. So this may end up chopped into content for us. And that's great, but it's real. And this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to talk to you. This has nothing to do with Instagram for me. I'm excited to talk to you. And this is going to be content. Awesome. Now, the problem is for me, other things, like I should probably get on a microphone and talk maybe more often. It'd be good for my business. But sometimes my problem is I think about, oh, man, what if I was writing a song? Like, what if my next song that could be my biggest song didn't get written because I was making Instagram videos? Mm-hmm. I struggle with that. So I hope I'm not butchering this question, but I would say content is really crucial. And when I signed a record contract at 17, it was about how many albums you sold. There was a thing in the contract, I don't know if this is private, but it doesn't matter to me anymore, that said anything that I do on video had to come out on my label's YouTube. And this wasn't even a thing then. This is 2007. So there's YouTube. Wow. But this was not a talking point. Everyone's like, who cares? You got a YouTube? Sweet, we'll put it out on yours. Well, now fast forward to 2024, like people make a living on YouTube. That's a huge deal. And so it just goes to show that it's an ever-changing market. I would say this, you know, for the young guitar player, if you want to make it as a career, focus on making as much music as possible, but you might need to focus on other forms of income, other streams of income, because it's getting harder and harder to make it as a musician these days, financially. Focus on social media because I know guitar players that I've seen on Instagram that have signature guitars like I do. And I'm like, I see a video and I'm like, oh, I want to hear their record. I can't wait to hear their record. And I go and there's no record because all they do is make minute long clips on Instagram. And so there's a line, I think, is my point. But the point is they have signature model guitars and they don't even have a record out. So to the young person, I would say if you can find a way to enjoy balancing content and creativity, do that. Look for other revenue streams, focus on social media if you don't hate it. I like to think at the end of the day, music speaks for itself. But, you know, I've seen some of the best musicians and best bands on the planet only sell 50 tickets. And it's tough. I would say if possible, be forward thinking and ever changing. Be quick on your feet because here's another example. TikTok came out. Like I was already had Instagram, I had Twitter, and I was like, this is when I post a new song, it takes me like an hour to do all these fucking social media things. And I'm like, yep. It drives me crazy. So then TikTok came out and I'm like, I'm good. I had seen all these other little, you know how the new social media platform will come out and it'll bomb after a couple of weeks. Yep. I'm like, forget this. I'm not even worrying about TikTok. Now it's the biggest thing in the world. And I barely have one. So it's tough because I'm answering the question in the best professional way possible. And it would be to focus on social media and focus on content, but coming from the guy who's really bad at it. So
I think you're doing great at it because you're actually living it. You're doing it. And another question, because as you saw on Instagram, I had people, you know, throw in some questions. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to tailor some to that because they have very specific questions about that. But the question I'll ask you is, how do we find our voice as a musician or as an author or any of those things? How were you able to find your voice?
I think it came through adversity a little bit, you know, to be honest, because there comes a time where when I started playing guitar, it was about how fast you could play. And when I got the tryout in sophomore year of high school for my band, they wanted to see how fast I could play. They're like, if you can play this part by this band, it's called Between the Buried and Me. They're like, if you can play that part in that song, like, dude, you got it. Like, it was almost like a test of your manhood on the guitar. It's like, could you play this riff? And so you're tailored, at least at my age. Again, this is before YouTube was too big. Like I was learning how to read sheet music. This is before tablature was too big. This is like, there's just different ways to go about all this. And so at this time, I'm like, it's all about how fast you can play. And then now YouTube comes out, now tablature comes out, and now all these kids are younger and faster every year. And I call it YouTube University. And I'm not complaining, by the way. It's amazing, and it's pushing the guitar to new levels as kids are better at younger ages. So the adversity to me was, I think I had this point in my career where I was like, for a while I was like pretty fucking fast, you know? And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm not that fast anymore. Like, not necessarily that I got slower, but these kids are younger and faster, and there's new techniques that I didn't learn because I was like learning the older techniques or whatever. It became what to me was finding your voice was, how can people know it's me? And it became kind of borrowing from a Randy Rhoads thing. Again, you don't hear my guitar and say, sounds like Randy Rhoads. I don't think. Maybe someone would, but I don't think so. Because harmonically, no choice, we do different things. But I would borrow like, hey, I want to sing like he does, but I want to have rhythm like Dimebag did in Pantera. And so like, I feel like finding my voice came from a variety of influences. I also think it comes from life experiences. You could go to a concert. Maybe someone drags you to a concert of a band you never go see, and all of a sudden you're floored by this live show. Maybe you're a metalhead and you go see this 80s pop band, and now you're like, oh wow, I can actually combine this to, I'm not doing that, but this is an example I'm giving. Yes. Oh, what if I had this like metal breakdown, but there was this like 80s funk guitar over the top of it? That's just an example. But, and all of a sudden you're doing something that nobody's ever heard before. There's a band called Polyphia in my scene, and they were shreddy guitar players.
Yes.
And one of them was my neighbor in Dallas. And all of a sudden they put out this record. He's listening to a lot of hip hop. All of a sudden they put out this record, and it's like hip hoppy drums with shreddy guitar. And that's because a dude liked to play guitar and play metal. And then he also liked to listen to hip hop, and he liked Drake. You know what I mean? So like, he found his voice in that way. So I think there's an element of, I don't want to say to steal, because that's not what I'm talking about at all. I just think it's meshing your influences from other places together, your life experiences, your musical flavors. And honestly, I think it just clicks for you one day. You're like, oh, this is what I want to do. I feel like I found my voice in my solo stuff, no pun intended, now that I'm singing, in a, by all the adversity that happened to me, and said, you know what, like, people think I'm either a metal guitar player or I write these happy poppy or solo records, and now I'm gonna put out this like super dark and melancholy release. And that happened through adversity. And so it is a gift. And like, I just think that as we find, I find youth right now, like anything that inconveniences them in any way, it is like the biggest fucking deal. And it's like, they'll just freak out and whatever. I'm just like, man, I don't love the bad things that have happened. And some of them I did to myself, but like, I can be real with myself to say that anything that happened, whether it's finding my voice musically or growing mentally, came from hardship and adversity. And it just so happens that I'm talking to the man himself, the subject matter king on this, that I just truly believe this, not just because we're talking, I just think it's true.
I couldn't agree more. And I, again, music is emotion. So that's why for you, especially going through what you've gone through, that, and maybe that's why it resonates for me, and I can feel the notes punching me in the cerebellum every time I hear you play. And back to what you're saying, I remember when, you know, Yngwie Malmsteen, and there was the whole shred culture that came through. And like you said, these guys were technically brilliant, but there was zero emotion in some of what they were playing. It was more of this technical skill, like the, they called it the Olympics kind of type thing, where it's like, what's faster than a 64th note? 132nd note. And then can you do a sweet arpeggio with that? Can you do it with 3 octaves? And now it's like, maybe, but I don't want to listen to that. It just sounds like harmonized shit. And now that doesn't make me feel anything. And then you look at the other end of the spectrum where, again, we have to have these, as you were saying, these combinations. If you're playing fast all the time, it no longer sounds fast.
Mm-hmm, right.
If you play fast and then have some soulful, slow, melodic vibrato and just punch people in the face with that and give them that ability to just feel you bleed into the speaker, and now you go back to this fast part, you give them that, and now it has even more impact and more power. Even as a speaker, I try to elevate and then I try to drop the bottom out and then come back and punch you in the face with something, so that now that I've got your attention, I can pour in this other balance, this other component. And some people just get that first part, and that's okay.
Wow.
I try to meet them where they are. So the people that want the deeper stuff, they can go to the layers, just like with your music. The more I listen to it, the more I appreciate it. But there has to be that emotional component. So as a young musician, whether you're 40 years old or 17, I think what you're saying is dive into your own experiences, trust them, and then learn to develop your instincts as you're going through and kind of palpate what feels true to you at that time. I'm an instructor under Bruce Lee's protege, Guru Danin Osanto, and he's in his 80s. So this man has learned and forgotten more about martial arts than what I'll ever learn in my life.
Wow. Yeah.
And he's always said, Marcus, the martial art that you practice when you're 30 is not the same when you practice when you're 40. And even though it's the same, because to be an instructor under him, you have to know Kali, you have to know the blade, you have to know the stick, the sword, you have to know Muay Thai, you have to know Cambodian boxing, you have to be at least a blue belt, like in jiu-jitsu, wow, to have all these understandings, Jeet Kune Do, Bruce Lee's art, Wing Chun, Kali, mm-hmm, Silat, all these mixes, right? But he says the blend that you come to when you're 30 is going to be a different blend and flavor when you're 40. Wow. Because of your experience, because of your preferences, because of your body's physicality. There's an example in the book where he says that, I took it, put it in the book, it's from him, but he says, there are 67 recognized judo throws, but yet a competitor at the highest level is using 3. However, they are aware of the other 64, so they don't get victimized by them, but they always go back to these things. So I think that's the beautiful part of, like you said, this journey. Appreciating the journey, appreciating the progress, getting to that place, getting through these successes are important, but again, being able to do this in a way that is edifying and fulfilling and sustainable and real, all those things have to be in congruency. They have to have this dovetail effect, because like you're saying, that emotion is always going to fluctuate, but being honest about it is what makes it sustainable. And yeah, that's what makes people want to continue to come to your shows and to listen to your music and to buy your guitars and all the things that you're doing out there. So I love that.
There's so many parallels between martial arts and music. I think maybe the doing jiu-jitsu and things like that, there's so many parallels with martial arts and life. So maybe that's the more accurate description, but it's fascinating. And I think you couldn't have said it any better that, 34 now, the 24 me was doing the same thing, but with a different approach. In 10 more years. So it's fascinating. It's couldn't have said it any better myself.
And having said all those things, who is a musician that you listen to now that just kind of blows you away? I mean, you mentioned, I've been saying it wrong, Polyphia, and again, they're incredible. And like you said, that album where they do Bad and all these other things, they had that real groove that comes in with that clean tone and that neck pickup, and then they just go right into this groove. But then there's still that shred component that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, man, I didn't realize you're super in touch with guitar and music. Love that.
Well, I try. Maybe that's why I like your stuff so much, I think.
You know, it's funny. I will say, though, as I get older, you ask me about people who blow me away now. I've kind of been going back in time. I don't know why. Okay, so after the split that I was talking about, all the things that happened in Dallas, I moved back to Chicago for family, because I grew up here, and my brother and sister are getting older. They're like 18 and 21 now, and I had been touring the world and living in Dallas when I was off tour that I feel like I missed so much of their life. And my dad's getting older, and I already told you how much of a staple in my life he is. My mother, my whole family that was there for me when I was at my low, you wake up from this coma and you see who's fucking there.
Yeah.
And so anyways, I'm back in Chicago, because everyone always asks me why Chicago, but I'm back in for family. And, you know, so I don't know if it's that reason or why, but I've been going back in time to what I'm listening to. And so Stevie Ray Vaughan was something that was big when I was young. And I think I'm listening to him more now than I ever have, because that was a situation when I was younger where it would be, in that case, it was somewhere on like, you know, you remember Comcast when they had like a music channel with cycle videos and stuff? I want to say my memory looks like that in my memory, but it was just Stevie Ray Vaughan live. And I just remember thinking, like, he is just like beating the shit out of that guitar. And it's like heavy and like sexy and like dirty. And like, it's just, and so, yeah, I've been going on a blues thing. Joe Bonamassa is another guitar player that I've been listening to a lot of. He's done some stuff. And yeah, you know what? Like, my dad and I are actually both sober now. But and he was never a problem, but it just happens to be that we're like that now. But there were nights listening, having some whiskey and listening to the blues with him that changed my life, you know, and rock and stuff like that. So yeah, I can't tell if it's because I moved back home and I'm listening to all the stuff, because this is the streets that I drove around when I was 16 and I moved back. And so I'm listening to shit I listened to when I was 16 again. I don't really know. But yeah, I'm kind of going back in time musically right now.
I think it's beautiful because, like you said, you've kind of come full circle. Robert Greene in that the book Mastery, he says, when you're not sure where to go, go back to the beginning.
Wow.
And for me, again, 38, get injured, paralyzed, have this great opportunity to come back. But now what do I do? Like, that was my adversity. It was like I survived. And I went from 180-pound, like, rock-solid soldier to a 230-pound guy. Like, lost all my muscle, gained a bunch of fat, trying to figure out what the hell do I do with my life now. And I couldn't go back to chiropractic school. I still have neuropathy in my hands and my feet. So it was like, now what? And for me, it was exactly what you're saying. I went back to my first love. I went back to martial arts and philosophy, started teaching it. I already had black belts and certifications. So I have a friend that was like nice enough to say, listen, get your ass down here. I want you to teach a class. And that's what I needed, was that kick in the ass to keep me honest. But through that, I rediscovered, and I don't just mean like the technical prowess to rediscover how to throw a punch or how to shoot a takedown or how to hold a weapon, but more about this beauty, this art, this entire encompassing ideal of the warrior, the ethos, the principles, the capacity to continue to push yourself, to ask more of yourself, to demand more, like you said, that discipline. That gives you those things. And then now, as a musician, we have to have those things. As a coach, as a leader, we have to have these attributes, because if we're not willing to do it, one, we're not going to be as good as we could possibly be, much like what your father was saying, where if everybody else is drinking and you're at home studying the guitar and playing, you're going to win. But more importantly, now that I have people around me that I lead, I owe it to them. I owe it to them to be the best that I can, to be the honest, most honest that I can with myself. Because how the hell can I be honest with them if I can't do that for myself?
Yeah.
So all these things are key.
I had a little bit of like imposter syndrome when I first quit drinking, because when you almost die, like, you're kind of scared straight. And so everyone's like, how'd you do it? I'm like, well, to be honest, like, if you went with what I just went through, you'd stop too. And I felt that way for a little while. And then you get healthier, and then you're like, I probably could have a drink if I wanted. But then what you just said comes to me, like, how my family dropped everything in their life to go to Dallas and be there when I was down and out. Like, how could I do that to them again? You know what I mean? And I've said this to them a couple times. I can't let anybody down. I can't let you guys down like that. Like, and they're like, well, you need to just do this for you. Don't worry about me. Don't worry about me. But regardless, that's where my head's at. I can't let them down again. You know, I had to cancel a tour or a couple tours. My band had to cancel a couple tours when I was recovering. And, you know, I can't do that to those people again that bought tickets. They forgave me once. I posted online, hey, I'm sorry, this is what happened. And everyone's like, dude, get your health in order. We support you. But you do that again and again and again, you're going to lose that. And they're not going to have your back anymore, you know? And so there is a big element of that, that you don't want to let people down. You owe it to yourself to be the best. You owe it to a lot of people to try to be the best you can be. I'm reading a book right now called Musashi, and it's about Miyamoto Musashi. Yes. And I'm fascinated by the way that there's a love story with him in the book. And he's so dedicated to his craft that he can't follow the way of the sword if I'm spending time with you, kind of thing. Now, that's extreme, and I'm not saying that, but it goes to show like the depths when it comes to greatness and people that are chasing greatness, how far they'll go to get that. For me, it was, you know, stay home on the weekends and don't go party. Stay when your friends are out on Saturdays, stay home, play guitar. For Miyamoto Musashi, maybe it was he couldn't be distracted by a love interest. You know, I'm fascinated. And again, it kind of ties into the martial arts situation where I'm fascinated by that world. And I think anybody can be inspired by it. You asked me what I would tell a young kid who wants to be a musician. And like, I would even say, pull up a martial art in your life, because that'll make you better at everything else in your life. I wholeheartedly believe that. I treat preparation for tour like a fight camp. So I play guitar every day. Like I said, I'm in here writing every day. Every morning, it's my favorite thing to do. When I'm on stage, my arm is going a million miles an hour for an hour, and it's tiring. So honestly, the hardest part about going on tour is the stamina in my arm to play those things, because it's one thing to play a song here in my chair, and then it's another thing to stand up, run on the stage in front of all these people, and do that for an hour. And so what I do, so if I'm off for 3 months, I'll play guitar every day just because I love it. But a month, or whatever. A month. I know fighters will do like maybe 8 weeks for a fight camp. But mentally, I treat it like a camp. Like, okay, I'm going on tour in a month. I need to ramp this up a bit. I need to stand up because this is another silly thing. Your guitar is right here. When I stand up and it drops down, there's like different muscles in your arm that are activated just by the tiniest movement of where your guitar is on your strap. It seems silly, but these are the things that I pay attention to. Yeah. But I got to get up on my feet and I got to play for an hour because I can play one song a day and make sure I'm good on that song. But then all of a sudden, 20 minutes into this craziness and my right arm's dead on stage, you know. My point is that these martial arts, there's so many ways that it just makes me a better person at anything you're doing. So I trained jiu-jitsu when I was in Dallas. I was training at Next Generation MMA, and Chris Brennan was my coach, and he has two sons. One's wrestling in Arkansas, one's in Bellator, and I would just see how they would approach these impending fights, and I would be inspired by it. And there's the time I was just like, okay, well, I'm kind of preparing for battle too, you know, like, you know, my guitar, I'm going on tour. And so they would start practicing or 8 weeks. They're always practicing daily again, because it's what we love, but you dial it up in a certain way with more intention, I would say 4 to 8 weeks out. And that's kind of what I do. So yeah, this is a long winded way of just saying, man, martial arts can just help you in any aspect of life, I believe.
You're very well-read, you're very articulate, but your humility is tremendous. And I think that that comes from the adversity, but also having a second chance. I think the martial arts have informed that. And I love that you brought up Musashi. I want to tie that in with the guitar component too, because they're, like you said, when people are playing fast, there's this gunslinger attitude is what we kind of say in the guitar world. Not that I'm part of it any longer, but Musashi, again, very much like he revolutionized the sword.
Mm-hmm.
Using two swords at that mm-hmm. time was pretty much unheard of. Using a shorter sword and using a long sword as this is the opening, the next line.
Yeah.
Moving this, turning here, and now the opening is there. Allowing the man to fall onto your sword, knowing the rhythm, because he talks about rhythm very much.
Mm-hmm.
For him, he had to choose. I can love this person. But he still had 61 duels to the death, and he survived. So that indicates what he's about. So he didn't have the luxury of some of these other components. And we look back, and here's the thing. Historically, it's easy for us to be in our place of warmth and safety, where there's not feudal Japan, where people are fighting over all these things and say, oh, well, how that's obsessive, and that's not healthy, and that's not whatever. He didn't give a shit about that.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't. Because if he allowed that to slow him down, even for one iota, we wouldn't know about him now. We wouldn't be reading the books about it. And again, very much this martial aspect into the guitar, he understood the opponent. He understood what he was about to face.
Mm-hmm.
He understood what this person's tenacity normally was. This person's very adversarial and aggressive. So I'm going to show up late.
Right.
For hours to piss this person off.
Yeah.
And this person is known for this big overhead strike. So guess what? If I piss him off, I pretty much can call the shot. I know where it's going to be. And if I condition myself to move out of the way just at that last moment and give him just a touch of this, whenever the sword contacts and he feels that through his arms and he gives all the commitment, and now he's open.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me also when he talks about he could be watching somebody paint or the way they do a tea ceremony, and he would like look at every little thing and be like, there's an art to the way they did that. Someone brought him a flower, and he's like, who cut this stem of this flower? This is a perfect cut. You know what I mean? He sees the art in everything, and it's so fascinating to me. Those things make me want to be better at everything I do. You know, sometimes I'll have tendencies. I'll play the same, maybe pentatonic scale, because I've been playing guitar for 25 years. I pick up the guitar, I play the same things, and then I'll read this chapter about Musashi and the way he looks at something. And I'm like, oh man, I just love that. I want to apply that to my life. You know, I'll tell you, one of the most inspiring people to me, I never met them, was Tu Lam, Ronin, I believe Green Beret. He's in the Call of Duty game, but did a million things before that. He's actually the one who sent me down the Miyamoto Musashi path, Book of Seven Rings, Book of Five Rings. And what other one? There's another one.
Musashi's the big one. Like the one you're reading now is huge. So
Tulam kind of was always talking about before actually sent me down that path. But, you know, I was watching a podcast with him and Sean Ryan, and it was just a fascinating podcast. And he went down the road of when Ronan, whatever he's most popular, but I'm not sure what he goes by, but got out of Special Forces, he has struggled with finding who he was and drugs and more prescription-based drugs from what I've gathered than it was a party thing. And people talking down to him on the internet or not maybe in life. And then I kind of applied it to people saying nasty things on the internet as they watch me be 19 and like successful kind of, you know what I mean? So this world of martial arts, this world of, I'm particularly interested in, I've been interested in, you know, people in special forces and any branch to the army, not just special forces, but just the sacrifices they make, but also the people that excel in it, the people that have attempted and been unable to. I just like martial arts to that, like all this stuff is just, I don't know. It, you know, Musashi talks about the way of the sword, the way in particular. And it's that he takes in everything in his life and he becomes better at the way through all of these, he finds his voice, let's say, through all of these life experiences. And so all the things that we're talking about kind of shape the way I play guitar. And these are the things that, this is why I was exciting to talk to you, because I knew that we would get to this. Being kind of not just talking about what's going on in the metal world right now, but coming from our backgrounds and our corners of the earth and talking, I knew we'd get down this road. And this is why I was excited to talk to you, but because I could feel this. And it's just that we have we're finding our voice through adversity. We're finding our voice through all these, through martial arts, through the way of our way. And it's just beautiful. And I hope that everyone can do that in their own journey, their own way, whether it's, you know, someone wants to be a forest ranger, a guitar player, an author, which is mind blowing to me for how much I read. I'm just so blown away that that's such a cool thing you get to do. There's so many parallels, and it's cool to talk to you and see that we look at the way we look at guitar and we do totally different things and we come together and have this chat.
Yeah. Once we see what did Musashi say? He says, once you see the way broadly, you see it in everything. And that's where that truth is. And I think, again, that's why game recognizes game, warriors recognize warriors, like recognizes like. Maybe that's another reason why your music impacts me so much. And again, even you made that comment about, so the pentatonic scale, which for those that don't know, it's five simple, quote unquote, simple notes. But yet you look at how Zakk Wylde did it. He revolutionized it. Or the way that Eric Johnson did it. And it was like, again, he had this beautiful, flowing, happy component. But when I would look at the tab, I was like, that's just a pentatonic scale. But yet the way he did it with the application or the way he would use it with a diminished minor arpeggio into it. And now you're like, wow, okay. And now, like you said, now it becomes this beautiful blend where it doesn't sound like a mix of these other people. It just sounds like Eric Johnson, or it just sounds like you, Lee. It sounds like with this expression of who you are.
Yeah, and I remember Cliffs of Dover for the first time just blew my mind, Eric Johnson. Yeah,
that pedal tone at the beginning after he goes through that whole thing and just goes into it in G, I was like, that's gorgeous.
To this day, one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's, we need to get you on the Q3 tour with him and
Steve Vai
and Satriani, right?
Those are all, man, I can't even believe I didn't bring up those names. I think my dad gave me a lot of music. I think my mom gave me a Joe Satriani CD. Which is unique because I don't even know if she was primarily in that genre herself. I think she listened to a lot of 90s country when I was growing up, which no complaints about that. But she ended up giving me a Joe Satriani CD. And that naturally leads you to Steve Vai if you weren't already there coming from the opposite order. Yeah, G3, man, how special is that? I've got some friends that have gotten to do that now. Are you familiar with Animals as Leaders? Mm-hmm. So Tosin Abasi filled in for my band briefly before right around the time his first album came out. And he has just exploded since then, and Animals as Leaders. And I'm just a massive fan of that band and him as a player and person. But I got to see him recently doing some stuff on G3. And I was just like, man, so deserved. Because again, I mentioned people pushing the boundaries of guitar. And yes. I mean, he's doing it more than maybe anyone at the moment.
But like you said, he's following that, his path. He's following that direction.
He has his way. And for example, we're talking martial arts, steering off being an author, being a musician. Like, he has a love for cars. And so he designs guitars now that you can totally see. He'll be like, the body of that Ferrari, that McLaren is kind of like that one guitar that you're making now. You know what I mean? So this is just how everyone finds their way. And I don't mean to discredit. Musashi's very specifically talking about a way, and he says the way. So it is one thing. But, and I don't mean to blur that line, but we all have to have our way of whatever that journey is, if you know what I mean. But yeah, it's cool just to see how people blend those together. And I think that's how you find your voice, you know?
I agree. And then I think it's beautiful with what you're describing, where I'm the way you are. You were talking about kind of going backwards in time to listen to things. If you want to learn something new, read a book that's old. Like, that's where it is. So I have all the respect in the world for a lot of these people that are, you know, talking about this philosopher, or talking about Stoicism or Taoism or whatever it is. But I like to just go to the source. Like, I just want to read what Aurelius said in the Meditations, and I want to take it for what it says for me. The Tao Te Ching, if I'm reading through that, that to me, because I remember the first time I took a philosophy course in college, and there was this person teaching, and they couldn't give a shit about what these other things are. This is just a TA that's like reading these notes. I'd like raise my hand and, you know, kind of counterback what they were saying. And basically he was like, listen, if you want to make an A on the test, this is what you say when we ask you this question. And it just killed me, because to me, having martial arts for that long and having it baked into your existence, and then having this person who doesn't even give a shit about it tell me that my interpretation is incorrect or ill-informed, it's like, you don't even know what you're talking about. You're reading something off a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And I'm quoting three different pieces of literature to reinforce this statement, and you don't care. It's like, no, he doesn't matter to him. He's just trying to do his thing. So that's where, again, going back to Stevie Ray Vaughan, I mean, come on, that guy sounded like he was breaking out of jail every time he picked up the guitar.
He sure did.
I mean, his facial expression and his body, and like you said, like he's about to break that thing in half. He's ripping strings off of it, throwing that thing down and grabbing another one. And I mean, that's just the, like you said, that raw, real expression. And that's where it is. And again, there was alcohol in some of his life, but he got out of that as well. And he found that clarity. And then that was one of his greatest, that was his greatest album, I believe. Like once he got to that place of having that cleanliness. But again,
because there's that fear, I think, at least I had it, and I'm sure he probably did too, I would assume, was it when you get off booze? You know, because I think when you're younger, like people be like, oh, that band was so crazy. They tripped pretty hard. Or like, oh, the Beatles are so amazing, but they did all this ayahuasca and all this stuff. It's like, you're like, am I going to be good at this once I'm sober? Yes. Not just are people going to like me, am I going to be fun on dates, but like, am I going to be a good artist when I'm dead sober? And, you know, I think I had that fear. And to me, making better music now than I ever have. And you, like you said, with Stevie Ray Vaughan, arguably put out his best music at that point. And I'm not on a anti-alcohol tour by any means, but like to try to put it down for people that can control it, that's so beautiful. I just remember thinking, man, I'm not going to be fun anymore. I'm not going to be good at music anymore. I can't even go on a date with a pretty girl. Like, no way. Like without a drink, are you crazy? You know, and, you know, one lesson I learned, and this is, I guess, random, but it's something I came to realize is, I remember thinking like, what if I'm out with people and they don't think I'm fun, or if I feel like I'm not having a good time with these people without liquor, like, man, I hope I'm not that guy. And it took me a while before I realized that like, you're just not around the right people then, because if you're sober and there's no connection, it doesn't mean they're bad people, but like, those aren't your people. And you may have gotten nested in with people because you had fun doing X, Y, Z. But I think that's a fear of anybody who's stuck on alcohol or any drug, is I think you have a fear that you're not going to be fun on a date, or you're not going to be as well spoken, you're not going to be as greased up in social settings. But I think that I just eventually learned that you're just not in the right setting then, and just find different people. It doesn't mean you need to wish anybody unwell, but maybe just switch your group up. I have been lucky that, you know, so I'm still around drinking and partying. Like I still tour, you know, I didn't stop. I've been lucky to have a band of people that understand where I'm at on my journey. And by the way, I never said don't drink around me or anything, but like, they'll be like, hey, we're going to have a drink. So they might go into the dressing room if I'm on the bus. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's important to have the right group around you. And this isn't anything groundbreaking, but if you have the right support system around you, that also helps these, you know, get you through adversity. I think that adversity does a lot for you individually under the hood. But, you know, if you can find the right group, maybe adversity pushes you into finding the right group of people that can lift you up. I forget the exact percentage, but there was a rule in a book I read that was like the 70-30 rule or whatever. And it was just about who you spend the most time with, you're going to be more like, blah, blah, blah. And maybe adversity pushes you to get yourself into the right group of people that can lift you up.
Yeah, oftentimes the biggest gift from adversity is to not put ourselves in the same positions that make us fail in the first place. And like you said, that I've heard that rule, and I've heard the five people that we are around, in my opinion, is more about the five emotions that those people evoke from us.
Yeah.
So you're around these people that make you want to be a better musician. You're absolutely going to go to that standard. Like you said, the military, the at 10th Mountain, like I guarantee you there was a standard, and it was like not the bare minimum that everybody else thought was great. It was like, that's just to get in as far as we're concerned. This is what we're doing. And then my squad leader and first squad, this whole idea of we had to be better than these guys. We're the tip of the spear. We're going to be doing the stuff, the crazy stuff that even those guys won't do. And that's what it takes. But I think, again, that's where we start to learn. And there are absolutely phases, there are absolutely seasons of our lives. And you moving on to this next place, whatever that looks like, again, we don't wish these people, you know, ill will at all. But for whatever reason, that's just not who you are. Or more importantly, it's not who you want to become.
Right.
And having the honesty to do that, that courage, a lot of people need adversity to do that. And if we're around the right people, adversity binds us together.
Right.
If we're around the wrong people, adversity pulls us apart. And that should be our kind of litmus test for a lot of those things.
It's fascinating. It really is fascinating. And I think that my adversity, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but I have personally noticed that a couple of the guys in my band who didn't have drinking problems by any means, but like I've noticed that they drink a little less. Maybe it's because I'm not there stoking the flame of the party or whatever, but how cool is it that maybe my adversity a little bit could maybe tone down some of their habits that weren't the greatest or something. And they've done that to me, of course. And so, you know, it's cool when you can take adversity and spin into a positive, because I think once it hits, that's about all you got. You can either crumble. You don't really have a ton of options when it knocks on your door. It's there. So make your move. So you're already dealt that hand. But how cool if that can maybe lift the people up around you a little bit, or vice versa.
You have the courage to overcome your adversity. You embolden others to do the same. And I think you're a great testament to that.
Well, thank you. And you as well.
I appreciate that. I could talk to you forever. I have talked to you for a while. Thank you for your time. I saw that you have a studio and people can actually come. Can they rent time? What does it take to be able to get into there?
In once the pandemic kind of started, it wasn't necessarily my choice, but who I was living with at the time, it was a situation where I stopped having people at the house. And since then, it's kind of just been, I live alone now, but it's kind of just been internet work. So if the right project came along, I would definitely work in person. But at the moment, a lot of it's just been mixing. So people have recorded music elsewhere. I'll mix it for them. A lot of people ask me to, maybe they're a songwriter who, maybe they live in a small town and they don't have a band, but they're a drummer and they can write guitar in a program, but they can't necessarily play it. So maybe sometimes I'll help people round out their band as far as recorded goes. You know, maybe there's one man band and they need me to play an instrument. So it's kind of shifted. It's not the typical come over, we'll mic up a cab and guitar and be in face to face as it used to be. It might go back there once down the road again. I'd like to open a studio, which would be a separate location from my house, because right now it's my house. And so for that reason, I don't do live drums here. If I want to do drums, I'll have to go to a local studio, another one. And then I bring everything back to this studio where I have amps and stuff behind you. It's hard to see. In my current setup, I can't do full band either. And so down the road, I hope to open a full studio, maybe have a staff working there, find someone who's badass that can work there when I'm on tour and keep the business going. Because for the most part, that business kind of stops when I leave on tour. I'd like to keep that going. Like I said, as far as music goes, it's important to kind of have as many revenue streams active as possible. If I could find a way to keep that business going, get updates on the road so I'm still hands-on, I'd be interested in that. Whether that's possible or not, I'm not sure. And I don't know how it would make people feel if they were getting something mixed by my studio and I wasn't in the studio. So I understand that. Again, it's something I'd have to navigate. But it's all things I'm interested in. But right now, People can write my studio, and I usually do mixing, mastering, adding. I've played all the instruments in my band, so like I can do keys or bass or guitar or things like that. And so, yeah, it's a little less face-to-face since 2020 and a little more internet.
And tell us about your signature guitar that we can get exclusively through.
Yeah, I had a headstock on my guitar. And then my company was doing a model called the Osiris, which is, my band is born of Osiris. And they wrote me and they're like, hey, we kind of have this theme going on and we want to use the word Osiris, but not that you own the word Osiris, but you have a band called Osiris. So we're like, can we use this name or would that weird you out? And I'm like, no, you do your thing. You believe in me. I believe in you. Do your thing. And they're like, okay, we're at least going to send you one. And this model in particular had a no headstock. So it's a headless guitar.
Yeah. It looks sick, man.
Yeah. And they sent it to me. And what I found was I would be on the couch and I would just stick it in the couch cushion. Cause just even 8 inches coming off the top of a neck, it doesn't seem like much, but when it's not there, all of a sudden a person can sit next to you and you're not poking them in the face. Put in the couch cushion, and I ended up playing a lot more guitar. And there's a lot of other reasons that headless is cool. Now, not everybody loves the look of it, and that's fine, but there are advantages. For example, when we recorded that first album I was telling you about in high school, when I was 17, I had a Gibson SG. It was my first nice guitar. This thing was like over $1,000, you know what I mean? It was like my baby, and it was in a hard shell case. Flew to California, spring break of senior year to record our first record. Flying back, the neck is broken. Which is crazy because it's a hard shell case. So this Gibson guitar, one piece, you know, it's not a bolt-on neck.
Yeah, yeah.
So that thing was pretty much in trouble at that point. I imagine people could fix it, but at that point in time, I didn't have the resources to find that person. Anyways, that was checking guitar. What's cool about the headless guitars is the cases are pretty small too. And so I can just throw them up above on the plane.
Overhead.
So
wow.
Guitars are within arm's reach of me when I fly now. So yeah, there's a lot of pros to it, but yeah, so now I do a headless model. We do 6, 7, sometimes we'll open up and do 8 strings. But that's not on sale 24/7. That's like more seasonal, but you can get the 6 string and the 7 string, year round. And yeah, it's a Kiesel guitars. What's cool about Kiesel too is I remember when I was young, let's say I wanted a Gibson Les Paul, You go to Guitar Center, they have it in black, they have it in white. Right. And if you're Zach Wilde, you can get it with the stripes right. on it.
Bullseye, yeah, yeah.
Bullseye, yep. But nobody else could, right? You had to be touring. You had to be someone in the industry to get a custom color or whatever. What I like about Kiesel is, first of all, American made here, but everything you can get, yep, everything. Let's say you had never touched a guitar in your life. You wanted to buy a guitar, but you wanted it in this crazy color. You could get it. You know what I mean? They don't care if you're on tour. They don't care if you have records out. Now it's a American made to order. So you pay a price, right. But you get what you pay for. But I think what's cool about that is people can get it in any color. So I like this blue color. I've been playing old Sunburst guitars lately. Probably the Stevie Ray Vaughan influence.
Yeah.
But people can get whatever they want. And I like that. You know what I mean? You're going to get the body wood that I prefer. You're going to get the pickup that I play. Cause it's my signature guitar. It still needs to be me, but yeah, you want to get it in, you know, purple, do your thing. You know what I mean? So that's one thing I like about the company. I think that they treat everyone like a rock star. You know what I mean? And how cool is that? Because maybe some guy's got money and he only gets to play one chord a night, you know, after dinner, like we were talking earlier, but he wants that guitar and he wants it in red with black racing stripes and he can get that, you know, and I like that Kiesel treats everybody equal. You know what I mean? It's pretty cool.
And so we can just go to Kiesel.com to do that.
Yep. And that's cool is they have a KieselGuitars.com and they have a builder. So let's say you click my model and you're like, it would be cool in red. But you're trying to picture it. Maybe you don't have the best memory or, you know, imagination like that. You can build it in front of you. You can do, I want a maple fingerboard with red. And you're like, you know what? Maybe that ebony would look better with that red. And so you build it right in front of your eyes. And on their social medias, it's cool. They have builder versus reality. And you can go and see what people clicked on the builder and then what it turned out in real life. And it looks even better in real life, which is what you'd want. You'd hate for it to be the opposite. Like, look like this in the photo and this is what I get in real life. So I recommend people go check it out. Even if they don't get my guitar, they have a ton of cool guitars to get. And so they have whatever's right for you, they probably have.
I love that. And where can we go to learn more about you, to purchase your material, to purchase your newest album? Where can we go to learn all about you?
Yeah, I would say social media, crazy to say. I guess I just, it's Leo Cyrus on social medias, Twitter, Instagram. Yeah, I'm now an independent artist. And so I need to get like a new website going and kind of a new landing page for all that. Yeah, I would say social media is the best right now. And I try to do my best to post whenever there's anything new. I may not be a daily poster like it would be beneficial to be, but when I do something that's musical, I'll let you know on there.
Man, I'm the same way you are. Like, I want it to be quality over quantity. And frankly, I get bored or calloused if somebody's posting three times a day and it's a bunch of pap. It's like, just give me something real. Like, I'd rather hear from you three times a week and have it be something important than trying to spam my inbox with a bunch of stuff or a bunch of bullshit that it pisses me off. It's like, I'll just mute that person or unfollow them. I would rather just give me something real. Absolutely. And all the stuff that you do. I also love, because so many people are buying tablature or buying your guitars, and they'll share it with you or they'll tag you in it. And you have this very, again, this very Stephen Pressfield mentality of, you encourage that person. Like, even, you know, the one that you had up today where there's a kid that's trying to play this incredible passage that you do. And he's like, I'm not as fast as the man, but you know, this is a pretty clean take for me. Mm-hmm. And you share that. So, I mean, that means so much to that young musician, just to get your attention or to get acknowledged by that. And what are you doing? You're making him better, because now, I don't know about you, but when I get awards or when I get accolades, I'm trying to get to the point where I can say, thank you. Mm-hmm. More importantly, that drives me to say, okay, I've got this. Yeah. And now I want to do this in a way, like you said. And I don't mean that it drives me to just like do more. It means to dig deeper, to find something that's striking that chord. If I forgive the pun, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Oh yeah. I think that that's important. You know, like, doesn't matter if someone can play something the way I play it or whatever. Like I said earlier, like, if they're having a good time, they're putting themselves out there, like, to post that on the online, like, go you, man. Like, that's fucking awesome. And whatever, you mess up a note or you didn't mess up a note, sweet. Some people post shit that play it better than me. That's cool too. You know what I mean? So I just think music and guitar should be love, you know what I mean? Like, and people can lift each other up. You know, I think that maybe in some industries, I'm not sure that I would agree with this, but possibly in some industries, there's not room for everyone, maybe. But I like to think, for the most part, if always, there's room for everyone.
I think especially in music, especially doing what we're talking about, there is, there's going to be no lack of space. Everybody's going to get it. And I think that that's so important that you're doing that. So thank you for the message that you're putting out, and thank you for the music, brother.
Dude, thanks for having me. And I'd love to come back and chat again sometime, man. Appreciate you. Appreciate everything you're doing and your message. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. I'm going to figure out a way to get down there to your studio and we'll record the Gift of Adversity song together. How about that?
Yes, let's do that, man.
That'd be sick.
If you need like a song for your podcast intro, I'll help you out.
Don't you threaten me with a good time. I'm taking you up on that.
Do it, man.
Thank you, brother.
Good talking to you.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Octa Nonverba. If this message resonates with you, please share it out with others on social media. Hit that subscribe button and leave a review for the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. To learn more, please go to MarcusAureliusAnderson.com and join his Octa Nonverba Inner Circle to get exclusive content, news, and information. Until next time, remember, talk is cheap. Live your life based on actions, not words.